This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
Good morning, boys and girls. I'm not sure any of us have ever heard a more unusual version of the Ballad of the Beverly Hillbillies, other than Ann Williams firing out with Bella Fleck and the Flecktones. Just in case you were wondering, that's what that was. It took me a minute to get that urbanized version, but I hope you enjoyed that little unusual break from our traditional bluegrass Sunday morning. Thank you for joining us here on the Wake Up Call today. I think we have a very interesting program lined up for you as we talk about drug use, drug abuse, and whether or not there are any levels of acceptable drug use. We have a couple of certified substance abuse professionals here in the studio today, Jeff Carr and Cara Marinucci. That's going to challenge me later on in the hour as well. I do want to thank Blue Ridge Graphics for helping us put this program together today. You can find them at the corner of Meade Avenue and East High Street here in Charlottesville, providing custom t-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. All right, let's welcome everyone with microphone and make sure all our levels are good for those of you on the other end of the sound. Kara, how are you?
Doing well, thank you.
A little closer.
Right here?
Oh, now that's very nice.
All right.
Thank you. A little bit about yourself, because you, I was going to use a word earlier. I was going to use counselor. And you are not a counselor. You have another.
No, I am a counselor. We'll get to Jeff in a minute here. I'm a licensed professional counselor in private practice.
Okay. And how did you get into that, and in what way do you assist folks who need it?
I've been working for over 17 years with adolescents and adults in a variety of ways, including folks who have issues around substances, which is including tobacco, alcohol, and other drugs. And one of the ways that I really try to reach out to people is looking at where they are in their readiness to do anything with what's going on. Sometimes people know they need to stop, and they're really not ready. Other times it's not a matter of stopping. It's a matter of looking at the consequences and dealing with them appropriately. So trying to do that, as well as using a technique with acupuncture needles that seem to be very helpful. We can talk more about that later.
Ooh. And Jeff Carr. Jeff?
Good morning.
Hang on 1 second. All right. Keep going.
Okay. How about that?
Nope. We may need to get you to move over and share that microphone with Kara.
I'll sit in Kara's lap.
Yeah. We'll do that. Ooh. No, try. You can use your microphone now. I can hear it in the background.
Okay, good morning.
Yes. And, Jeff, how did you get to your position in the substance abuse world?
Largely divine guidance. I've been working in it about 16 years as well, and when I went into graduate school for counseling, I didn't know what kind of counseling I wanted to do, and at the end, when it came time to do an internship, I wanted to find a job that would count as my internship to get my degree. And someone said, why don't you go apply for this substance abuse counselor job at an adolescent treatment place? So I went, got the job, and 3 months later, I realized I was doing everything I wanted to do and getting paid for it. It was great. It's a wonderful country.
And, Kara, did you two ever work together?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we worked together for probably about 10 years.
All right. So today's topic then being drug use. First of all, tell me what qualifies as a substance because when I was doing my homework on this, I found the word substance rather than drug in a variety of ways, and I'm curious as to how that all played out.
Either one.
Well, we'll just take turns. I'll start with just saying that substance is a good word to use when you're trying to just talk about anything that is mood-altering, that a person's using to change how they feel, change how their body works, for whatever reason. So that can be tobacco, alcohol, what people consider illicit drugs. It can be over-the-counter. It can be medications. So it can be a number of substances, and that's why we use that word, to just have a broad category.
Yeah, because I found one of the more interesting things is, and I'm going to toss this out early, I went to a website, NIDA, which is National Institute of Drug Abuse. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's one of the government agencies.
The National Institute of Drug Abuse says that the cost to society of illicit drug abuse is $181 billion a year. But then, you know, buried a little further down in this rather long paragraph, said when combined with alcohol and tobacco costs, they exceed $500 billion a year, including health care, criminal justice, and lost productivity. Which means that they didn't sort of point out the fact that alcohol and tobacco are almost twice as much.
Funny how they left that out, huh?
All right. Jeff, we're still working on your microphone a little bit, and we're going to have to twist that towards the middle so that you guys, so I can hear you both equally as well, so that our listeners can hear you as equally as well.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Oh, now see, there's the magic sound that we've been waiting for. I was thinking that you said you went to Blue Man Group last night and that somehow your voice was lost cheering on.
Yeah, I was yelling so much. Yeah. I'm borrowing someone else's voice this morning. What the comment I had made was, yeah, funny how that works. That
tobacco and alcohol are sort of overlooked in comparison to illicit drug use.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's really important to point out that part of that is our tendency to want to make it about good and bad, or about who are we going to punish or blame, instead of looking at the health issues and looking at how it's affecting individual people and their families. When we start looking at that, then we can really see that if we're not looking at, okay, who are we going to blame, but who are we going to help, then we're looking at alcohol and tobacco causing significant difficulties for people throughout their lifespan, whether they're children growing up in a family where alcohol is an issue, or they're elderly and they're starting to use medications inappropriately, or having emphysema or lung disease because of long-term smoking.
Yeah, labels don't have a lot of use. I think it's much more important to look at, as what Cara said, the behaviors, the consequences, who's being affected by this.
We are talking about drug use today and the different categories, I think, that go along with that, with Jeff Carr and Cara Marinucci, area certified substance abuse professionals. And really, for those of you who are already sort of ticked off at the show topic, I just want to let you know that the goal today is for people being able to make informed choices for a healthier living. Is really the goal, is a little more education for personal choices. One of the things that I found interesting that came from Jeff, because I'm going to stigmatize you with this,
okay,
for all the callers.
Need a scapegoat.
Right. Is what are the various stages of use? And you wrote me that the stages include none, mm-hmm, experimentation, routine use, substance abuse, dependence, and then death dying.
Yes.
I'm curious as to how that works in terms of identifying routine use, abuse, dependence. Because I know that there are large numbers of people out there who would assume that after you experiment, then you got a problem.
Mm-hmm. And I would disagree with that. When I came up with this continuum, just not out of a textbook or anything, just from the people that I work with. And for the example with routine use, the general criteria for that is that their use is predictable, that it follows a pattern, but most importantly, that it doesn't produce any negative consequences. And to a large degree, you have to talk to someone to find out if they've ever experienced anything unpleasant with their use.
Let me ask you both of you, when you say doesn't produce any negative consequences, is that completely mental? How much, you know, how much physical?
Anything.
Access falls, you know, falls into that?
When we do an evaluation with someone, we talk to them and say, people will say, oh, I've never had any negative consequences. And I'll say, well, have you ever had a hangover? Oh, yeah. Well, have you ever drank so much that you threw up? Yeah. Well, do you enjoy vomiting? No. That's okay. But that's the point is, how many times has someone said, oh, I'll never do this again, and then be out the next weekend or maybe even the next night doing the same thing again? You know, with other activities in our life, when we experience unpleasant things, we tend to change our behavior. It's just human nature. When it comes to substances, we will often try to change everything else except for the substance use.
And again, to note that you picked up on that it doesn't necessarily have to be an external or physical thing. It can be, but it might be something like acting in ways that are inappropriate and getting sort of embarrassed and having other people, you know, let you know, hey, what you did wasn't cool, or just feeling guilty or not feeling comfortable inside yourself about the amount that you're using and how that's working for you.
So what does qualify as acceptable drug use to Kara, are you backing away because you don't...
No, because Jeff raised his hand.
Okay, I just want, because I want to find out, because again, I know that there are certainly a large percentage of people who aren't listening, and I would expect that there are at least a few people who are listening, who would say there's no acceptable drug use.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have to go back to the word substance instead of drug, because drug has such a pejorative term to just being illicit drugs. So I think we're trying to stay out of that area, but talking about what's healthy and not healthy.
So snorting coke when I want my blood pressure to increase doesn't qualify.
Probably not.
Okay.
Probably not.
But what would qualify?
When I'm working with the groups that I see, the example I use are my parents. My parents like beer with pizza. Whenever they have pizza, they have beer. Now, in 40-some years, I've never seen them drunk. I'm not saying they never have been, but I've never seen them that way. I've never seen them hungover. They don't have pizza every Friday night. 1 month, they may have none. The next month, they may have three. But by golly, when they have pizza, they have beer. If they don't have beer in the refrigerator, one of them will go out to the store, buy a six-pack. They'll each drink one bottle of beer with their pizza. Not because they have some hard and fast rules. Don, you're only allowed one beer. You know, it's just that's their pattern. What do you think they do with the other four?
They probably sit there until the next time they have pizza.
They stay in the refrigerator. Now, for some people, that's substance abuse. Leaving those poor, lonely beers in the refrigerator, in the dark, cold, shivering, never knowing when they're going to get picked up again. You know, for some people, that's abuse. But, again, for my parents, it's predictable. You know what's going to happen in a given situation. It's part of a pattern, how it fits in their overall life, and doesn't, to the best of my knowledge, has not produced any negative consequences.
Well, what else would qualify? Sorry, Kara.
Well, and what he just said picks up on some of that when you said part of their overall life. I think it's important that when we're looking at, you're using the word acceptable, and again, I'm going to go more towards healthy. It's part of an overall life. It's not the center point. It's not the focal point. It's not the reason for doing it, which is moving towards on the continuum that we're talking about from use to abuse to addiction. that's when you start moving towards abuse, is when the whole reason you do something is so you can drink, so you can use, so that you can get into that altered state. Whereas when it's more in the acceptable range, it might be there, it might not be there. It's part of an overall life that is not, again, having negative consequences because of that use.
Again, with my parents, if they were out somewhere and they were at a party and pizza was offered, but there wasn't any beer to drink with it, I can't imagine either of them getting upset, saying, no, I'm not going to eat pizza. Or, you know, there's just not that much weight pivoting on it.
All right, 11:15 here on the Wake Up Call with Cara Marinucci and Jeff Carr. As we talk about drug use and the patterns that go with it, the methodology that goes in helping folks who have reached an abuse and dependence level, that's my next question is, how do you determine, what are the rules that go from determining someone from abuse to dependence? It seems like it would be a fine line.
Well, can we back up a step?
Of course.
To going from use to abuse. It just diagnostically, if you use the DSM-4, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual version 4, it has all the mental health diagnoses in it. We can't give someone an abuse diagnosis, no matter what the substance is. It's the same criteria unless there's a recurrent problem. There's four criteria, and the beginning word in each one is recurrent. Recurrent failure to fulfill major role obligations. I'm drawing a blank on the other three. But basically, it's recurrent. If something happens one time, you know, maybe it's just bad judgment, bad luck. I'm not sure what that is, but it has to become recurrent to even be considered abuse.
All right, I'm going to get somebody. Scott, are you there?
I am.
Got Scott from Belmont. What you got for us?
Well, it seems like, how should I phrase this? I don't really think there's much of a controversy here per se. I don't think anybody in the either medical or psychology or counseling community would advocate drug use to any of their clients. So I think, and then maybe this is a question, I'd be surprised if there are any mainstream counselors who say any drug use at all is something that they would want to work on with their client. And this is, again, separate from the question of legalization or whatever. But so I guess it's a question for them. Is there really any disagreement among treatment people on, say, the use of cocaine versus the use of alcohol versus the use of marijuana? I think they would apply the same standard to all three of them in terms of making decisions with a client about whether that's something they want to work on.
I think if someone were to come to me and with a situation like you were describing, one of the things that I would want to explore with them is the concept of risk. You know, what if they're considering using a given amount, you know, what are the risks associated with it? You know, certainly with some of the substances like, you know, what people call the hard drugs, cocaine, heroin, there's a much higher percentage of people who just, when they try them, are much more likely to become addicted. I mean, it's like 3 or 4, sometimes 5 times higher than what you'll find with alcohol, even with marijuana. I'm not saying that one is there's no risk and the other that there is a lot of risk. It's that it's a continuum. It even plays into part or factors in what's their family history. You know, if a person has a family history of alcoholism but no history of cocaine addiction, they're still at a much higher risk of developing a problem if they even experiment with cocaine. The odds against them are not real good.
Kara, your thoughts on that?
Well, I would just follow up on the part of how people need to look at what the different risk factors are in their life. And that could be a number of different things. That could be their family history, of course, which is partially genetic, partially how they learn to cope with different stressful, difficult situations. Other risk factors could simply be their own life, the type of work they have, the stress in their present life. There are certain occupations, for instance, that put more stress on people's life and sometimes tend to have a culture which can, if and in fact, they a lot of these, I'm going to just point them out, doctors actually, and helping professions actually, and teachers and police officers, and that's not saying that you're going to see more people there having problems, but those are the type of people that experience a lot of stress, and that sometimes when they're aware of that, I actually have worked with a number of people. They're not experiencing an addiction, but they realize that their use could become problematic because the reason they're using is to try to cope with anxiety and stress, and so they want to change that pattern before it becomes a problem.
Even just on the issue of risk, I work with a lot of people that are truck drivers, professional drivers. They have a CDL license, and they get tested pretty regularly. And the Department of Transportation there's not much tolerance. If you have a positive urine screen or something, you're going to get referred to treatment. And so the person there who's considering using, their chances of, coming under scrutiny are a lot higher than someone who is a self-employed painter, say.
All right, folks, feel free to dial us up, 979-0919. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. As we talk with Kara Marinucci and Jeff Carr, substance abuse professionals, as we talk about drug use. I do want to tell you, markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Sunny today, highs 40 to 45. Clear tonight, lows 25 to 30. Sunny tomorrow, highs 50 to 55. Right now in the valley, it's clear and 30, cloudy in Lynchburg and 32, some clouds in Richmond where it's 42, and clouds in Charlottesville, 36.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let's thank Five Guys Burgers and Fries for their support today. Five Guys serves America's standard fresh and handmade from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., and they're open until 10 on Fridays and Saturdays. That's Five Guys Burgers and Fries behind the fountain in the Barracks Road Shopping Center. They're in the Hollymead Town Center and now on the Downtown Mall here in Charlottesville. On the web, it's fiveguys.com. That's FIVE guys.com. And we want to thank folks like Kale Jaffe, Brenda Clements-Jones, and Jeannie Joyce for contributing to NRN's fun drive in the fall. It's because of people like them that you have the wake-up call on every Sunday from 11 to 12. Also because of program underwriters like Tiger Fuel and The Hook this hour, as well as folks like Hampton Inn and Suites and Revolutionary Soup. So stay tuned to tell a friend about all your fun programs. And be sure to support us in our upcoming spring fun drive. All right, back in action here with Jeff and Kara. We were talking about what the difference is between someone who experiments and then routine use, abuse, and dependence. Are there sort of set definitions for that, or does it depend on who you are as a person, as a counselor or whatever, and then, or is it dependent on who you work for, if you work for a group? How does that work?
Well, diagnostically, it's pretty consistent. I made reference before to the DSM-4, and any counseling professional should be using the same criteria. Now, of course, everyone's human, and they have their own biases and just things, warning signs that they're going to focus on. But we should all be in the same ballpark.
What is, let's stick with something, I don't know, with beer or with,
I think one of the things just to look at for everybody, not just professionally or diagnostically, but when we're talking about substance abuse, one way that I often talk about this is where you start seeing some red flags. This is the point where you may be able to step back from it, and you may be able to evaluate it and say, okay, I need to really modify my behavior. It might mean because of your own personal and family history that you actually decide to stop, even though you're not considering yourself to be addicted. Or you might just be able to modify your behavior at that point. So again, looking at what that means you know that your use is because of trying to alter how you feel, how you're coping with something. It's also becoming a little bit more predictable that you will try to use in certain situations. It becomes the focal point rather than the other event, the social event. A common way that this happens for a lot of people is at first when they go to parties because they want to see people. And then they start going to parties because they want to be at the parties where they can use or they can drink. And then they won't go to a party unless they know they can do that. And that can be some of the progression that we're looking at is, so how does that, there is a progression. It's not always so simple, and that's why I use the term red flags, because one person might get one red flag, like they go to a party and they get really drunk and they get hungover and they can't stand it and they never do that again. That was their one red flag. They said, not going there.
This is not worth it.
This isn't worth it. Other people, for whatever predispositions that they have, they're going to try it again because there was some payoff in that. And that's one of the things we need to understand about why some people progress to an abusive pattern or to addiction and why some people don't. Because for some people, the way their brain is made up, they actually do get a payoff for it, even though the after effect seems to be, why would you do that again?
And sometimes it's an exaggerated
such
payoff.
As what? What kind of payoff?
We're talking neurotransmitters, the natural feel-good chemicals in your brain, the dopamine, norepinephrine. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the...
Serotonin.
It's serotonin. These are all part of the reward circuit that every human has built into their brain.
So we have this pleasure center in our brain, and we all know it. We have natural highs. Hopefully,
chocolate.
All of you out there have natural highs. Chocolate, yes. That's one of my favorite mood-altering substances.
Nutty bars.
So we have this pleasure center, and we can access it in a lot of different ways, through music, through running and exercise, through, and as human beings, it's a wonderful gift that we have. And one of the ways that it can happen in excess and actually interrupt our natural way of doing it is when we continue a pattern of using substances in a way that overdoes the circuit. It floods it so much over and over again. So again, we're not talking about back in the continuum about use. We're talking now that we've reached a pattern of abuse or addiction, and how that progression happens for somebody is that their circuits get, and this is really just a basic way of thinking of it, that the chemicals come in and they take over, and the other natural transmitters you have feel like, well, we don't need to be here, so we won't show up for the party.
Right.
What carries you from abuse to dependence?
I think it's certainly the negative consequences, and then the negative consequences become recurrent. But it's when the unpleasantnesses, the negative consequences, when those become a standing pattern. Doesn't have to be happening every day, but when it becomes pretty predictable that you're going to have a hangover. I remember this one kid working, his final defense of why he didn't have a substance abuse problem was because he knew that evening when he started out drinking, he knew he was going to end up drinking to the point of getting sick and throwing up. And because he was planning that and predicting it, it must not be a problem. And everyone in the room just kind of looked at him like, do you really believe what you say? And even he heard himself how odd that sounded.
Yeah, a common way to think about once you get to the dependence or addiction stage is if somebody's unsure, they just need to try to stop or cut back and just see, because the physical side is they could have actual withdrawal symptoms. And again, it may not be that they're using every day. There are a lot of people out there with alcohol that they certainly have an addiction, and it's a binge pattern. They only do it on the weekends. But that doesn't, you know, so a lot of people use this framework, well, if it's not in the morning and it's not every day, well, certainly there is that type of alcoholic. But there are also people that have a different sort of pattern, and it's still addiction because it has that long-standing pattern. They would have withdrawal. They have a huge increased tolerance. It's uncontrolled in the sense that they can't stop once they start. And it's a preoccupation. It's the most central relationship in their life.
And that's. This might be a good time to just list the seven criteria for any substance dependence.
Let me throw out that phone number again real quick. 979-0919, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS is the toll-free line. You want to call up and ask Jeff or Kara a question or make a comment on today's topic.
Okay. The seven criteria are, Kara just mentioned tolerance. If you notice that you can, it takes more to catch a buzz or that you can hold more. If you know, it, withdrawal symptoms is the second one, which can be mental, emotional, physical. The third one is uncontrolled use, which an easy way to ask this is, have you ever used more than you planned to when you started out that day, that evening, or over a longer period of time? The fourth one is an unsuccessful effort to reduce your use. Have you ever thought, yeah, I probably ought to cut back and do so, but then go back to the level you were using before? The fifth one is preoccupation, which Kara mentioned.
Preoccupation, that's like planning ahead as to how...
Yeah, a lot of time is spent planning for, getting the substance, using it, and recovering from the effects. It's like when you, the example I use with people is when you have a crush on someone. You know their schedule, you know their friends they hang out with, you know you look forward to being with them. Time with them goes by quickly, and then when it's over, you look forward to spending time with them again. When you have that kind of relationship with your substance, that's usually a warning sign. The kid sitting in the back of their class doodling pot leaves on their notebook, they're in love. So that's the fifth one. The sixth one, we've already talked about negative consequences. And the seventh one is continuing to use even though you've had negative consequences. That says one of two things. Either you don't care or you can't stop. And when someone doesn't care about the negative things happening in their life, that's a warning sign about something. So, out of these seven criteria, a person only has to meet any three of the seven. Most, I won't speak for Kara, but most of the people that I've worked with over, in the last 16 years, they don't have what you would stereotypically think of the physical addiction.
If they have three, they qualify as what?
As chemically dependent, whatever the substance is, cocaine dependent, alcohol dependent, nicotine dependent, nutty bar dependent.
Wow.
Any three.
And dependence is further up the ladder than abuse?
Yes. Yes. It has more.
Is it just me, or does that mean that like more than 50% of the nation is suffering from dependence?
No.
If you throw in tobacco.
Well, that's the thing. When you throw in tobacco,
coffee.
Lots of times when you see statistics and they're talking about addiction, first of all, they usually refer to those harder, illegal stuff.
And they leave out alcohol and tobacco.
They leave out alcohol and tobacco a lot, and those are the big two. Those really are. And so we do need to look at it. If you're looking at alcohol, we usually say about 10 to 15% of the population might move into the area of addiction with that. Tobacco, we actually, I think, are around 20 to 25%.
So I don't know that one as well.
It's decreased because we really have had a country that's moved in the past 50 years from a country where a lot of people smoked, and they weren't necessarily in an addictive pattern. We do need to point that out because there was a time in our culture where it was sort of, if you showed up at this certain thing, you did smoke a cigarette. So, yes, are there people out there who've done that? Sure. But nicotine is probably one of the most addictive. We talked about how risky a substance is. Mm-hmm. It can create those receptors in the brain and have a pattern bond really quickly. Usually within 10 times of smoking, a person will have that happen at that level, at the receptor level.
All right, let me ask a question. Jeff, you made mention earlier about your parents... Mm-hmm. Who have an acceptable use because they have one beer with their pizza whenever they have pizza. And that's an acceptable use. It's not...
Well, I'd say unproblematic use. acceptable is pretty value laden. So yeah. I would just say I've never known their substance use to cause them problems.
Where do you throw age into this topic? Because I'm assuming that your parents are old enough to buy beer.
Yeah.
Is it okay for, you know, does it fall into that level for a 20-year-old, a 25-year-old who may be old enough by driver's license but may not be old enough or may not be that old in a mental fashion, a 14-year-old?
Yeah, I'll start with this. I'm going to start with what Jeff talked about, unproblematic. That's a good way to look at it because sometimes what seems to be unproblematic short-term can be problematic long-term. And one of the things we know about the brain is that it continues to develop until at least age 25.
That's just what I was going to say is, you know, especially with younger people, again, I'll say under 23, 24, 25, the neural pathways and the neurotransmitters and the receptors, those things are still, those building blocks, those pathways are still being laid down up until about age 25. So whatever you do, I guess chemically, maybe even behaviorally, to alter those pathways, you're talking about some fundamental structures that you're changing, you're laying down for the rest of your life. So the earlier someone uses, certainly the risk is greater.
And we do know that through the research as well as working with adolescents for a long time, that the earlier somebody starts using, even if it seems unproblematic at that time. In other words, I know a lot of times parents will say, well, you know, we usually have wine with our meals. Would it be okay? And this gets into this whole, and I know this is a huge issue because I hear it from parents and from adolescents, is the cultural issue. What's okay? What's not okay? And what I usually just want to say is let's look at the risks you're setting up or not setting up, not just yes or no, because that can be really hard. And I'm not getting into the legal parts of it or any of that around age, but just that the younger somebody starts using, even if it seems to be within a prescribed cultural situation, that because the larger a cultural context in this country is one of drink to get drunk for young people, for a lot of, I'm not saying all of them, but for a lot of our bigger culture of the United States, that's the message that they get, is that if you're going to drink, you're going to get drunk, that it can cause problems.
What other reason is there to drink? Isn't that the only reason to drink, to get drunk?
All right, don't be smart.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
11:38 here on the Wake Up Call with Cara Marinucci, Jeff Carr, as we talk about drug use, some of the categories that go along with that. Feel free to dial us up. I see the phone's ringing now.
Great.
So we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, photo red cameras have become the law of the land. What does that mean for local drivers? A lawsuit prolongs the life of the now infamous Mold House. And did you know area protesters may help Planned Parenthood raise money? The Hook explains how. The Hook, one copy now free with this coupon. Go pick it up. And additional support also coming from 45fix.com. If you have a project but not the time, there's a simple way to find a contractor. From kitchen and bathroom remodeling, house painting, to decks and siding, it's 45fix.com. Immediate, no obligation estimates available anytime. That's the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. And don't be going anywhere, because at noon, it's Les Temps Purdue. If French isn't your thing, that means the time's gone by. And on WNRN, that means 80s and 90s alternative. Tune in for it next. Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music, only on WNRN. All right, here we are back in action with Jeff Carr, Cara Marinucci. And our caller is still out there talking to Michael. You can call us up, 979-0919, 1-877. WNRN Rocks is toll free. Call up, speak to Michael. He will patch you through.
So I'm, while we're waiting for our caller, one thought that came to my mind is to just put out there a little bit. One thing that I often talk with young people, as well as adults, but it particularly happens when we're younger, even in college or as a young adult, is our perceptions matter a lot. And what I mean by that is oftentimes that we think other people are using a lot more than they really are, and that sort of shades our own decision-making. The classic term is peer influence, but it doesn't have to be called that. It's also just what do we think is normal? And if we think it's normal for everybody to go out every weekend and drink five or six beers, then that does enter into our brain, unless we're really, really sure we're not going to use it all. That might influence us a little. And what a lot of research has shown over and over again is that people overestimate, by and large, how many people actually are using, how often they're using, and how much they're using. Mm-hmm. And then they think they're the ones that are the odd people out when they're not using as much, when actually they're just like everybody else when they're having that one or two.
So you think that increases the number of people, just sort of this false peer pressure that isn't really there?
Yes, definitely.
And you discovered that through your
Well, there's actually really
job?
Good... Well, through anecdotally, and there's an area of research called social norms that's really helpful in understanding how... And it's not just about this. It's about our...
This is human nature.
Yes.
We tend to hang around with people who do the same things as us. Like on this continuum, about a third of the American population does not, at this time, at any given moment, doesn't use a mood-altering substance. I'm not saying they never have, but at this point in their life, they don't use. Now, the people that come to us for counseling, they look at us like, you're making that up. It's because that's not the people they spend time with. I don't know about Cara, but I can say none of the people that I'm close friends with are users. Not even routine use. Some people are recovering addicts, but some people used to use and just don't do it anymore. And then there's some people I hang with that have never used.
And to get this out of, to make this about all of life, this could be, do I think that somebody else is eating dessert or not? Do I think somebody else is doing their homework or not? Do I think, it's about all of human behavior. And when we guess what other humans are doing, we compare ourselves to that, and then we see where do we fit in with that. A classic example is, especially again, I look at college students, and they'll go to a party, and they'll see people drinking, and they'll think, well, everybody's drinking. Well, usually, no, not everybody's drinking. Then they'll assume if they see particular people they're drinking that they drink a lot or they drink often, when no, that might be the one time in the month they decided to drink. So there's a lot of assumptions we make that are part of trying to figure out how do we fit in.
All right. Our caller didn't want to come through. I think this person is afraid of having a recognized voice, but I do have some notes here. Glad you're talking about this. No one ever wants to. Been an alcoholic since age 10. Doesn't drive. She drinks because of a panic disorder. This allows her to handle it better. Her sister doesn't drink, but she's on all types of medication. Is one way of coping really better than the other?
I suppose the short answer that I would offer to that is part of the difference between maybe dependence and addiction is certainly there, like diabetes, for example, that someone may be insulin dependent. If they don't have it, their life and their circumstances are going to be impaired. However, I wouldn't say that they're addicted because they're not experiencing negative consequences of their use. They're not going through the things in the criteria. So with the caller,
not necessarily abusing the drugs that
that a
medical doctor has prescribed for them.
But although certainly that is possible,
yes.
Again, with the two people in question, one is using alcohol to manage their anxiety. The other one is using a prescribed medication. Both can be abused. The difference is like if I were talking to them and doing an assessment, I would ask the person who's drinking, what kinds of effects or consequences do you have from how you manage your anxiety? I could also ask the same thing of the person taking the medication. What kinds of, and we would likely get pretty different answers.
979-0919 1877 WNRN Rocks. Welcome to call up and ask a question or make a comment. If you want to be like our last caller, then just pass it on through by Michael.
And I do want to commend them for not driving.
Yeah. Question. You know, we've talked a little bit about throughout the hour. By the way, if you weren't here to join us from the beginning, www.seavillepodcast.com. I'll give that to you two later. www.seavillepodcast.com. And you can catch us from the very beginning. I'm curious in terms of, you talked about, and again, I'm stuck on the word acceptable, but you gave me another word that I haven't been able to.
Unproblematic.
Unproblematic. Is it okay if, I'm curious as to getting the connotation versus the denotation of the word. Unproblematic. If normally I don't really do anything. I don't smoke. I don't drink. But in the past, during my experimentation time period, I found that, you know, smoking a joint is not such a big deal for me. I don't like to do it regularly just because I don't need to do it regularly. But I'm more of an introvert. And my wife or girlfriend wants to go out to this large party. And I know that it'll make me a little more extroverted, and so I'll be more comfortable. I'm a writer or a painter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when needed, not every time, but when needed, I find my muse a little better by having something. Is that okay?
Well,
Or is that need to be followed by about 25 questions before you can
yes.
determine
there
that?
You go.
Yes, and part of that is as you were asking the question, you used some key words that I would actually follow up on if I were actually sitting in my office with somebody, and that is a word like I need. Needing it to function is actually something that can be a high risk factor, even though you were trying to phrase this scenario in a maybe, maybe not all the time, not all the time. But still, the fact that the motivator is a sense that I need to use this outside substance to change how my body works and how I function, we would probably want to get a little bit more into that and figure out how can you do that without using something that has that risk of becoming something that you're dependent on to continually do that.
Do the majority of certified substance abuse professionals agree, understand that there is this level of it's okay to have something as long as it falls into the unproblematic category? Or is it you go from nothing to problem that you need to go back to abstinence?
You'll get the whole range. There are certainly 20 to 25 years ago, the majority of the substance abuse counseling field was an abstinent only. You know, if you use any at all, that's just too much risk and you've got to stop. That's one of the things that substance abuse counseling came under criticism for, is it was one of the few branches of counseling that sort of demanded the successful outcome right at the beginning, Again, what we know of humans and human behavior, that's pretty unrealistic. Most people don't make changes that way. And that's one of the things that we wanted to get to. Was there's a theoretical model called stages of change, and it categorizes people by their readiness to make change. They go from, there's pre-contemplation, in which people, they're not really even thinking about making changes. I'm doing what I'm doing, and I may or may not like it, but I'm definitely not thinking about making changes. And then the next stage is contemplating. It's just where you begin to think about, well, I kind of don't like when this happens. So I don't like drinking dark liquor. I don't like what it does to me. So I'm going to try. You know, so people are beginning to think about.
Yeah, the bourbon gives me a hangover, but the rum, man, the clear liquors.
Oh, yeah.
They don't bother me.
And this is the stage where people do a lot of bargaining. If they mm-hmm. are actually in an abuse pattern or even addicted, they'll be doing a lot of bargaining. Now, if it's more that they've had a couple red flags, they might be more inclined to take some action sooner, because that's the third stage, is to take some action and then hopefully maintain those changes in behaviors, and that's the fourth stage, maintenance. And again, it depends on where they're at. If what it was some red flags and they just simply needed to reassess and evaluate, what am I doing and how do I really want to do this, that's going to look like one pattern. And if it's somebody who's addicted, they're usually going to go through a longer period of pre-contemplation and contemplation because, again, the relationship with the substance is primary. We see this with people trying to quit smoking. You know, it usually takes on average 4 or 5 times for a person to try, you know, to actually attempt to quit before they actually quit for a significant period of time or what they would consider, yes, I'm finally quit.
And this model isn't just about substance use. This is about behavior change. So it can apply to dieting. It can apply to, you know, any kind of change that someone's wanting to make. They go through these stages.
If you have gone beyond experimentation or even and again, that word has escaped me, acceptable use, unproblematic use, and so that you have moved to substance abuse or dependence, is the only proper next step to go all the way back to none? You may have to go back step at a time. I realize that you may not be able to go from
all at once,
from dependence back to zero all at once, correct? You may have to, you know, go back down the stairs a little bit. But is the only, you know, once you have reached abuse or dependence, is the only correct end result to be not using it at all?
What I think is important is to look at what's going to be the healthiest position for each individual. And only they can answer that. Only they can really answer that. I never tell somebody this is what they have to do, but I will try to help them see what their options are. Because, again, what we're looking at is what is their willingness to engage in changing whatever behaviors. For some people, and this, you know, look at heroin, they'll use methadone maintenance. Mm-hmm. And that is basically replacing one substance with another substance that they can actually function on.
But they're not stealing. They're right. Not sharing needles with all the, mm-hmm. the
disease. We did a program here, I don't know, 10 months ago or so, on the fact that I believe a UVA professor has come up with taking a drug to stop drug addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really? I'm looking at the reply to that, the thoughts on that from my substance abuse professionals here in the
I think
today.
I want me first. No, I was going to say just that the field has really grown a lot in that we're really looking at what are the individual circumstances, because some people for the longest time the model was abstinence, was go to AA, NA, and really hardcore confrontation around, you know, you need to change your behavior and do it now. And although that might still fit for some people, mm-hmm. and AA and NA are wonderful,
yes.
valuable resources that we really need in all of our communities and are invaluable, there are some people that need something a little bit different. And I think it's incumbent on us if we're trying to help all people, regardless of it's an abuse or an addiction issue, that we're looking at what's going to meet those needs. And for some people, the first step is just being able to back off a little, and that might be through using a medication.
Yeah, I have two comments about that. One is, you know, the topic of taking a drug to stop taking another drug. The thing I would really focus on are the negative consequences. You know, which do you have? If you have less negative consequences one route than another, then why not go the other? I mean, I go back to what Cara was talking about with what is supporting your short-term and long-term health. There was a guy that
Hang on, caller.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
Oh, there was a guy I used to work with at the HIV clinic, and he was a pretty regular drinker, and even he acknowledged that his drinking was causing him problems. And after about a year or so of meeting with him, I had just started working there, so it's the first year or two, he said, "I know that you don't approve of my drinking and how much I drink, but you have to understand, I think my drinking now is a lot better than it used to be. I used to be the town drunk that everyone stepped over on the sidewalk. I used to pee in the street, and I used to pass out in the street. So where I am now is a lot better than where I used to be." And I got that message loud and clear.
All right, Bob's with us. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Rick. So my question quickly is, how do the people you're talking to see emotions and thinking patterns, emotional and thinking patterns in the addiction pattern? Is that something that they talk about?
All right, keep listening.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
The first thing I would talk about when you asked about emotions, feelings, and thinking is that they are integral in looking at how you change your behavior, because oftentimes it's patterns in responding in a certain feeling or thinking way that continue to shape our behavior and make us think we need to pick up that drink or we need to pick up that joint. And so we're talking about triggers. What's going to trigger me? And there's a situation where something happens at work, and my immediate response is to do the same old, and to get really upset and stressed out, and then to start thinking that nothing's ever going to change, and nobody cares about what I do, or fill in the blank, and whatever sort of thought patterns would reinforce my urge, my craving, to use. So one of the things I work with clients on a lot is that we need to look at what those situations are that tend to bring up that urge to use. And you really do need to identify what are those feelings that come up, what are those thought patterns that come up, and how can we start proactively setting up responses so that you can look at how do I want to feel. Well, I want to feel calm, so this is what I'm going to think to myself. And this, instead of storming out or instead of going to my phone and immediately calling somebody and telling them what are jerk my bosses or whatever, what I'm going to do is this. So we look at actively changing thoughts, feelings, and behaviors all at the same time by looking at which ones are going to impact the other.
All right, 11:57 here on the Wake Up Call, last few minutes with Jeff Carr and Cara Marinucci talking about drug use. I do want to let you know and remind you, you are listening to WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. And want to take a moment to thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support today. Famous for durable outdoor gear and your source for trail running footwear, including Bat Pelks clothing and new Patagonia stuff. Also at Blue Ridge, it's the area's premier selection of rain gear. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is in the Barracks Road Shopping Center here in Charlottesville. You can find them at Wintergreen and in Richmond, plus at brms.com. All right, I think that there are a fair number of people out there who would love to ask more questions or get a little more information without having their voices over the air. So I want to make sure that we give phone numbers or email addresses, et cetera. You're always welcome to email me, and I can pass this on, abstractme@AOL.com, and I can give you email addresses for it, Jeff or Cara. Cara, we talked briefly early on about acupuncture as a method to help people. Let's take the last minute and talk about that.
Sure. Thank you. One of the techniques that developed in the late 70s, early 80s is a protocol of using acupuncture on the ears. There's 5 points on the ear that we use needles on to help decrease cravings, and basically, in an acupuncture way, what we're trying to do is call the body into balance by using these points to stimulate a reaction that helps the person move more towards health. And what I really want to be clear about is I'm a registered trainer and acupuncture detox specialist with the National Acupuncture Detoxification Association. I'm not a licensed acupuncturist, and I often refer people to acupuncturists who want acupuncture for, like, a full body acupuncture for more reasons. And I just want to make sure that's clear. But this particular technique, which we've been allowed to do in Virginia since 1995, allowed to do as acupuncture detox specialists, is to really assist people with substance issues in decreasing their cravings. And it can happen in any part of, they could be pre-contemplative, they don't really think they have a problem, but they're willing to come to do something to help them with some of their physical symptoms. It helps people sleep better. There's usually a relaxation response. Mm-hmm. They usually end up just overall having a general sense of well-being that helps them get to a place where they might consider, what's my next step? And that's why it's so helpful. And we found
it makes making changes that much easier.
Because it's not really about confronting somebody or engaging them in a really difficult way. It's letting them listen to their own inner wisdom and to go inside and find a way to look at, what do I really need to do?
All right. Again, email me, www.cvillepodcast.com. We'll put some links up there for you as well. Next week, Bar Hoppers. We'll have a crazy hour next week with the Bar Hopper theater group. Jeff,
Carl? How's that for irony?
Yes, well, thank you so much for coming in today.
All right, you're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Tim's is up next.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or at wnrn.rlc.net. The wake-up call is produced by Michael Strickland. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.